put this
in between us. If you could make sure we talk loud, so.
All right.
It is 2:15 on March 4th, 2010. This is Brad Bondi. I'm joined by Mr. Brian Leach, Brad Karp, PJ Mode, my colleague Karen Dubas, and
Bruce Bierenbaum.
Mr. Leach, I asked you before we start, do you consent to be recorded today?
Yes, no problem.
Thank you. Ms. Dubas and I are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We're a commission set up by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis and to do a report to the President and Congress and the American public on due by December 15, 2010. Our mandate, as I mentioned, is to look at the causes of the financial crisis, both globally and domestically. We also have been tasked by Congress to look into some various issues like lending practices, securitization, counting taxes. The list is 22 items specifically. We've also been tasked with investigating the financial institutions that collapsed or would have collapsed but for government assistance. Our inquiry and how we conduct it is confidential, so we ask that you don't discuss what we talk about today with anyone outside of your lawyers. However, we anticipate that some of the information may be used in a report or a public forum as part of our mandate. I'm obligated to tell you, sir, that because we're government agents, that 18 U.S.C. 1001 applies, and your lawyers may have told you what that means, but in a nutshell, it means that it's a crime to knowingly or willfully provide false information to the government. But I say that only to put you on notice, but I have no reason to believe that you're not going to be truthful today, but I'm obligated to tell you that. Could you please state your full name and spell it, and your title, sir?
Brian Robert Leach. Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, Leach, L-E-A-C-H, and my title is the Chief Risk Officer of Citigroup.
And how long have you been the Chief Risk Officer of Citigroup?
Since end of February 2008. I think the first day was February 26, 27, somewhere in that.
And what was your background briefly prior to joining Citi?
I was with Morgan Stanley since from 1981 to about 2005, with a couple years off of business school. At Morgan Stanley, I had a variety of jobs throughout that time. The last job I had was as the in business unit risk manager, reporting directly to the president, which was Vikram Pandit at the time, and I had a 1 year where I was seconded to long term capital management to try to help unwind LTCM, and then post 2005, I formed a hedge fund with several Morgan Stanley colleagues who left Morgan Stanley, called Old Main, and then joined Citigroup in the February 2008 timespan.
Yeah, you've been designated by your counsel as someone who is knowledgeable about the need for government assistance in 2008, Citigroup's need for government assistance. But I also understand that you're prepared to talk today about risk management more generally. Is that your understanding as well?
Be happy to.
Okay. If you don't mind, given our brief time with you today, which we do appreciate, if we could take those up in opposite orders and talk first about risk management, if you wouldn't mind. First, if you could help me understand, what does a chief risk officer do? What do you do at Citi?
Okay. So a chief risk officer is trying to understand all of the risks that an organization is committing capital to, and those typically, in risk parlance terms, tend to be thought of in terms of market risks, credit risks, operational risks, and franchise risks, and each of those has slightly different ways that you would look at them. Unique ways of measuring them, but there are also ways that you look across all of them. And so when we look at our portfolio, we think about the risks within business lines, within regions, and then you want to look at those risks along multiple dimensions. So in some cases, you might, and in risk terms, generally speaking, what you're trying to do is understand the possible, the range of outcomes that could occur in a in an asset class that you're looking at. And the range of outcomes can, if I do it by analogy, if I use the weather, we would say there's a pretty high probability that the weather, the temperature tomorrow outside will be somewhere between, let's say, 30 and 50 degrees if you're in New York on these days. There is a lower probability that it might be between 20 and 60 degrees, and an even lower, remoter possibility that might be, 0 to 100 degrees, outside of 0 to 100 degrees. So each of those ranges of potential outcomes have a lower and lower probability. What you're looking for in risk is to try to understand that the potential for each of those outcomes, the one that you would say is fairly expected and then the ones that you would think is fairly unexpected. And we do that with a variety of different tools. At the very extreme, there are regulatory requirements for a certain amount of capital, and that is when those are designed by regulators, they are designed to sort of capture the most extreme of moves. And then you have things typically where you move in the curve to the point where what you're looking at is the daily volatility of your P&L. And so a variety of different cuts that you look at, and those apply to, that same concept is what you apply against, market risk or credit risk or operational risk. You try to think through those potential outcomes. And then you try to determine whether the risk and reward is appropriate for the types of risks you're taking.
To whom do you report?
To directly to Vikram Panda.
Do you have any other reporting chains?
No, I do not.
Who reports to you?
I have a team of people. Just to be clear, you mean report as it requires, as you mean reporting lines as opposed to reporting material. I give reports to a variety of people, but I report directly to Vikram Panda.
It's a fair question. I was contemplating the reporting line.
Okay. The group that reports to me has different expertise. So I have, when I think about the layout of how to manage risk, I've found over the course of my career that you do a better job with risk management if you have different perspectives. And that, frankly, certain people have different skill sets, and it's rare to get someone who has a monopoly on all knowledge. So I try to find people who can give me a different look. And we've organized risk here to help me with that perspective. And that's something that obviously I did when I came to the firm. So one of those dimensions is where I look at risk along business unit lines. So we have here an institutional business called ICG, and there is a chief risk officer for ICG. He reports to me. His mandate is to understand ICG.
And forgive me, what does ICG stand for?
Institutional
yes.
client group. Thank you. I've gotten so used to the acronym, I'm not sure I was clearly going to stutter on the name. We have another business that's the consumer group, and again, we have someone who is a chief risk officer there, and she reports directly to me. We have a commercial banking group. They lend to small business. If you think of the first one as large businesses, the second one was individual consumers. The third one tends to be smaller businesses, commercial lending. And that person reports to me. And then there is a look that is the private bank. And again, that person reports to me. So those four business lines are one dimension of risk. And I expect that each of those risk managers, they have substructures below them that help them understand the risk within those businesses. What I have added some other dimensions, and one of the other dimensions is a regional perspective. We operate around the globe, and we have I have chief risk officers for each of the major regions, so for Asia, LATAM, and Europe. And the people who are in, who are the chief risk officers for those regions, they, their responsibility is to understand all the risks in their region, regardless of the business unit it's in. So if you think about that, first group has business units. The second group needs to have a perspective of their, of all those things across the board. And that is, for me, very helpful, because you frequently will have, for example, right now, with some of the concerns about the countries in the European Union and what impact they would have, you want to really have a regional perspective and be able to look at the risks in the region, not just by the individual business units. So again, I would have, I have several chief risk officers by region that are my direct reports. And then I have a group of people who are product experts. And when we make commitments, frequently where the underlying component of the risk has some similarities or commonality across the business units. And I wanted to be able to have a product expert who could really think about that exposure holistically across the firm. So, for instance, one of those CROs is for fundamental credit, and that's because, you know, we lend money to either the same institution through a couple of different business units, or more commonly, an industry that has, you know, where the commonality would be at the individual level and the institutional level, but the industry looks the same. So the fundamental credit person, again, looks across without regards to geography, without regards to the business units. That person pulls that picture together. So I refer to that as a triangulation on risk. I get a look at it from three different angles. And then that structure is built on a foundation where there are common elements, Brad, that are required to sort of allow each of those to function. And those common elements, one of those is a technology common element, where we want to make sure we have the same metrics that are being applied regardless of it, make sure we have, you know, good quality data, et cetera. And then there's a operational risk tends to be, you know, cut across all those lines, and the amount of capital that's required. And so that's the structure. So a group that reports to me that builds the foundational elements, and then the triangulation structure.
Now, when you started in late February of 2008, how did you learn about the risk management that had been in place by your predecessor? Did you do any sort of review or study to see what was being done, and how did you evaluate what had been done before your arrival?
You know, I didn't spend a lot of time on the history because, you know, frankly, there were so many people that were not at the firm who may have been involved in that history. I felt also that the history also may come with biases that may be positive or negative. I just wasn't sure. I spent really a lot more time on saying, what do I need to do my job? Mm-hmm. And so I spent all the time trying to say, so I have some experience in the subject matter. So it was, what do I need to do my job? And then ask the question, I need the following. Can I have it? And if the answer came back, well, yeah, you can get it, but it's going to be a week or it's going to be 2 weeks, that was one where I'd say, okay, I'm glad that I can get it, but my turnaround time is faster than maybe what the organization might be. Or if I got, questions about, whether that could be provided or not, you know, that gave me more insight into the fundamentals of what needed to be done. So I really spent the time trying to think of what do I need to do my job, and that's what I focused on.
And I know you've described, and I appreciate the description of some of the reporting that you put in place, but what I'm trying to understand is what has changed in risk management since your arrival. Could you describe the categories that have changed, and then we can get down into some of those categories, and any sort of reports that you now receive that you didn't receive at the time you started, and so on. How did risk management change since your arrival?
So I think we've done a fair amount in that space, again, to assess, to really respond to the things that I wanted to look at. The management structure, which I described to you, had the business unit management structure, and it had a regional construct, but I wanted the regional construct to have much more authority in those spaces. I felt that the world was it had globalized, but we were now in a situation where certainly a lot of the regions or the countries in the regions had an interest in what was happening in their backyard. And, you know, prior to this crisis, I think people's thought was that the home regulator kind of had the full responsibility. And I think post the crisis, particularly I think post Lehman, there was a view that each of the local regulators who had subsidiaries in their own backyard wanted to know everything. And so we needed stronger regional CROs, and that was something that I think we beefed up that a lot. Then I mentioned the product CROs. The product CROs was new. For Citi, I introduced that here. You know, sometimes those roles can be played informally, and I don't have an opinion about those, whether they were played informally. You know, you frequently will, I'm sure, in your day-to-day job, if you have a question, you kind of know your network, and you can call someone and get an answer to it. I came in here, I didn't know any of the network. There's 375,000 people, and in terms of the people I knew at Citi, I probably knew a handful. So I had to create some structures that allowed me to be able to get that. So that structure was changed. I'm agnostic as to whether it was done by casually rather than the formality that I introduced to them. I think we spent a lot of time looking at risk capital, and in particular, fattening the tails of the extreme events. And again, some of that's responsive to what had happened in the fall of 07. The fall of 07 was a pretty dramatic change in structure. It was, in hindsight, it was a baby step relative to the fall of 08. But in the fall of 07, you were beginning to see markets really have some pretty big fractures. And I felt that the risk capital and the potential for problems was something that we needed to be better about. So I changed, I put in some different managerial structures. I changed most of the team. I maintained only two out of the original 13 that reported to me. I brought in about half from outside the firm, and about half were elevated from inside the firm. As I said, it changed risk capital. We started to reevaluate the VAR of the firm. So if risk capital defines the endpoint, VAR defines more of the belly of the curve, and we redefined how to look at that. We reevaluated all of the risk limits for the firm. Again, we're a smaller institution than we were at the peak, and so. If you got to react to what you have. We had a portfolio that was obviously losing us a lot of money, and we needed to get smaller because of that. But we also, as a company, we were getting smaller as well, and that required us to shrink as well. So in that interim time, I mean, we've reduced the balance sheet. I'm sure you probably heard some of the numbers, but we reduced the balance sheet by about $500 billion from like 2.2 to trillion to 1.7, kind of a 25% reduction. We released in every one of our, I shouldn't say every one, I think we released in most of our Qs the positions that we considered troubled positions. And in that $500 billion of reduction, a good chunk of that were the positions that were the most problematic for the institution. We raised a lot of equity capital in the fall of 07 and the early part of 08 before we got to the government raising of equity, because frankly our concerns were that the portfolio had loss potential that, you know, you need to we didn't forecast that you would arrive at Lehman, but if some bad things were going to happen, then in fact the portfolio had too much exposure, and we needed to raise equity capital to be prepared for a potential downside. And we raised a lot of cash capital. So we increased our cash capital significantly in both the 08 and then again post-Lehman, once again in 09, in both cases raising it by a substantial amount. We increased the number of meetings with the board and the Finance and Risk Committee. And I say that because we certainly had a lot of meetings with them, and I can't imagine they had as many meetings as we had. Because the market the market situation has significantly changed. I changed the goals of the organization. So I feel very strongly that. I wanted to make sure risk understood what independence means, and again, I'm saying that without bias to history. I'm saying that with that it was important for my group to understand that they were independent, and I wanted to make sure there was no uncertainty at all about that message. And I believe they were independent historically, but that was a key item for me to stress. But I wanted them also to understand that they were not to be isolated in that. And I think that sometimes risk managers use the independence to not have to be subjected to peer review. And I happen to think that peer review is a very powerful tool. And as long as if someone is judging my work, I think you do better quality work. And if I'm allowed to say you're not, if I was allowed to say you can't judge me, I think the quality of work is not as generally suffers. So I wanted to make sure I got a couple cultural things across to my group. How important it was for them to speak up, voice to be heard, recognize their status and stature in the partnership. I made sure that every place risk was being committed to, that the risk personnel was involved in that decision-making process. So that's some was structural, some was limits, and some was cultural is how I would summarize it, Brad.
Now, do you have a budget that you control for risk management, and how does that work? Is there a budget that you have?
I do have a budget.
How has that budget changed since 2006, if you know? I mean, what is the amount spent on risk management at Citi? How has it changed?
So I don't know the 06 and 07 numbers. I'm sure I can get them, but I don't. Again, that's the history part. I didn't care. What I know is when I came in, I was not budget constrained. So mm-hmm. I inherited a budget. I was told hire whoever you need, build whatever you need, and essentially submit the bill. And that was supported not only by the board, senior management, but I'd also say it was supported by the regulators, who were very curious as to whether we in this process, laid off a lot of people as a company, and we also cut expenses by a lot. The risk group was not subject to that, and that was something that the regulators were very focused on while I came into the shop. Now, as time marches on, if your company is shrinking, you would expect that the risk group over time, you know, if we're not going to do business in the Antarctic, I don't need a group of risk people down in the Antarctic. So, so you would expect that it would shrink over time. But our focus on the risk group is I've focused on processes and improving those, because I believe that I can get more value for this firm and for the industry and for the country by in fact preventing problems. And if I prevent the problems, they actually overwhelm the economics of the individual who is working on the problem. So.
Have you engaged any consultants since your arrival at Citigroup to analyze the risk management or anything relating to risk management? Mm.
We've had some analysis done. I don't believe I've engaged a consultant, and I'm saying that with some hesitation because it's a question of the definition. So if I look under the subgroups that I have, I've authorized some of them to, in fact, work with consultants to have them think through various processes. And the board did work with some consultants to analyze the risk format of things that I was doing and spent some time on that. But again, the details of that would be more the board for those results.
Were you involved in that process,
though? Yeah, they would come and talk and ask about that.
What consultants were retained by the board to analyze risk?
I knew you were going to ask that. Can I come back to you on the name? I'm sorry. It's as I'm given when you started on the job, I'm sure the last 2 years is kind of a blur. So we did go and talk to a number of I know a fair amount of other risk managers and tried to, you know, do a little bit of best practices. What are you doing? And how are you set up? And I did go with one of the board members to talk with some of them to get some to have some chats with them. And the regulators also set up some industry-wide items where they had a variety of global regulators in a large room with a bunch of us and kind of went through best practices. So there were a number of studies done during that time where they tried to highlight what were good and bad practices during that span.
How many people at Citi are devoted primarily to risk management? And I understand that may be a difficult question because in the global sense, everyone should be thinking about risk management.
Absolutely.
But how many persons report down the chain from you to ultimately up to you that primarily are focused on risk management?
So I'll give you the number, but it's a number that I consider to be a fairly competitive advantage number. So I don't know exactly how many people are in risk management, any one of my competitors, and so how big that is, I would be a little bit concerned about that being in the public domain. So trying to abide by your request, I'm going to answer here, but I'm giving you an opportunity to tell me whether I should answer in some other fashion.
Well, I appreciate that some of the information is proprietary, and we are requesting proprietary information from banks and financial services firms and the like.
No problem.
Mr. Karp and I have had a lot of discussions in terms of how information is ultimately released that may be non-public information. We'll certainly take that under consideration. It's ultimately, though, Mr. Leach, as you can appreciate, it's not my call. It's that of my client.
Understood. As I said, I'm going to answer. Yeah. I just hadn't.
Yeah, for the record,
Brian, why don't we designate this portion highly confidential? And we have our separate understandings as to the added layer of protection we have with respect to this category of information.
Terrific. So I have about 3,000 employees who work for me in risk, and they are all directly involved in risk. There are an incremental amount of people beyond that and who are have risk-like functions, but they are in the business unit, and so I want to distinguish between those two groups. And so if you look at some of those functions, you pick up roughly another 3,000. And then beyond that, you get to people who every day of the week or every minute of the day are making risk decisions where they're committing the firm and all, but they are not part of that independent risk group. So for my group, it's 3,000 people.
And how has that number changed over time?
It's on an apples-to-apples basis, it's roughly the same. When I first came in, the day before I came in, it was about 3,000. About a week after I came in, it was 6,000. And about a year later, it was 3,000. And the reason is because that 3,000 that was given to me, I looked at it and said, honestly, that's not what a risk group, I think, does. And it is that's the independent group that I said was in the business unit. And just to try to put a little bit of context behind what that is for you, Brad, because you got that look like, okay, wait a minute. So it's in the consumer space, in the credit card space, there are a lot of people who, I'll take a hypothetical. If a person was struggling to pay their credit card, they might call up and say, I can't pay $20 this month, but I can pay $15. In essence, that's a risk decision. The person's saying, okay, we'll take the $15. That's a risk decision. I don't consider that a risk control, a risk governance person. And so when I first came in, there was a thought that it would make sense for me to take all of those people. And what I felt was that, listen, that's a very valuable function, but the way I like to run risk is I want to run the governance side of it. I want to be able to, I don't want to have to, that's a client service job that there's going through. So I wanted a very clear line behind what really was independent risk and what would be in business unit risk and what would be risk taking. And my view was I wanted to draw a very fine line, strong line between what was my responsibility and what were others. And so we looked at the group, did a extensive analysis, and determined that, essentially most of them needed to go back. And I think it was 2,000, so I'm a little concerned that it was 3,000 of maybe 5,000 and something and back to 3,000. So if you could, if the precision matters, tell me, but I'll get you a better number.
What would be useful, I think, is if we could see numbers of risk personnel over time, persons that were devoted primarily, again, to risk person, risk management, how that's changed over a course of maybe 2003 to present, and how the budget's changed. As you can appreciate, we're looking at risk management, not just from Citi, but from the industry as well.
Yep.
So, Mr. Leach, I appreciate that you were focused on changing things going forward. But when you arrived in your position in late February of 2008, you inherited some exposures that Citi had announced. And by that, I mean, in November 4th, 2007, Citi announced somewhere around $55 billion in exposures to subprime. In the super senior positions and the commercial paper that was brought onto the books as a part of the liquidity puts, part of the positions in the mezzanine, CDOs, and the like. What, with respect to risk management of those positions, did you do?
So, that was one of the reasons why I brought in the product CROs. So the product CROs I brought in, I mentioned I had several. I talked about fundamental credit earlier, but the three product CROs I brought in was one was someone who looks at real estate across the firm, the other who looks at structured credit, and the third being fundamental credit.
And who were those persons, or who are those persons?
They are people who had roughly 20-plus years of experience in the industry. The fundamental credit person was a Citibank, former Citibank employee, had been a Citibank employee. And the other two were people I brought in from the outside world.
What are their names and what were their responsibilities?
So Greg Hawkins is the real estate person, and he had been in a couple places, but I happened to meet Greg when I was at LTCM. He was an LTCM partner, but he had worked finance background, and that he had built a lot of the original models to think about how market structures work, and So he was someone who had a lot of experience on how to think conceptually about the markets, and also had this market experience that's hard to generally find. Usually you kind of find someone who is more model-driven and less market-oriented. He had a really good mix of it. And then the second for a structured credit was a gentleman by the name of Adil Mathani, who we had brought into Old Lane. And he had, again, 20 years of experience prior to that, working at running a structured credit type of desk at one of the other Wall Street houses. And so I, and then the third hire I had was looking at the amount of capital we have, which was a gentleman by the name of Charles Monet. And Charles was brought in as someone who would understand how much capital was necessary to carry various risk positions. And those were three of those, of that management structure I spoke about, where I thought that it was so important to have that perspective.
Did you make any changes to how risk was managed with respect to those exposures to subprime and subprime assets, in particular the CDOs?
I mean, the reality was at that point you couldn't move them. There was no market, and the market was changing so dramatically that I'm not sure you could ever find a price that made sense in any sort of, unfortunately, historical context. What we tried to do was we looked at the overall riskiness of the firm. We tried to reduce riskiness where we could, and you focused on the CDOs, and rightly so, but there were a variety of positions that we had inherited that were difficult for the institution. And I think that your focus on CDOs is absolutely appropriate. I mean, if you look at the crisis, there are really four institutions around the globe who had relatively larger CDOs than everybody else, and those are the four that have had the biggest difficulties. So it's Citi, it's Merrill now B of A, it's UBS, it's RBS, and every one of them has had a disproportionate exposure for that. But the other portfolios, the other assets that were there, did cause problems for really virtually the entire industry. It's just, generally speaking, people didn't have an excessive concentration in a position like the Lev5s or other. People had roughly the same market shares. I think you'll see in some of the public records, we sold a lot of we sold a fairly large piece of leverage finance in the second quarter of 08, it might have been first quarter of 08, where at the time it received a fair amount of publicity for having Citi unload this, and I looked at that as being a way to truncate some of the fat tail that the overall portfolio was displaying. And because some of that was the fact that we had this CDO position that was, which was obviously causing so much difficulties with the institution.
Mr. Leach, I can imagine that when you arrived and saw the exposure, almost $60 billion or so in CDO-related and subprime exposure, you might have asked questions about how Citi got to that position. Did you look or evaluate at any time the risk management that was being conducted up until that point with respect to CDOs?
No. I mean, it was I had the position. You're in risk management mode, and I'm trying to figure out how to make sure the place gets from this day to the next. So it wasn't going to help me to know beyond the fact that I own the position why the position got there. And in many ways, other than making sure that we had a structure that I thought was going to help us not go to that same place. Again, I think that I've been through so many of these types of crises. I shouldn't say so many, but certainly the experience I have with LTCM and others. The story you get told is always different than what someone would have thought they were saying 6 months earlier. 6 months later, it's in the depths of a crisis, and invariably, people seem to remember they were worried about this or worried about that. And the reality is, I've just found that whoever you're talking to, generally speaking, looks completely brilliant, and the person who's not there is the one who tends to have made all the bad decisions in the world. So I just haven't found that to be incredibly fruitful. What I do find is important is let's find out what the size of the risk is, what do we own, let's dimension the entire spectrum of it, and then given what we have, what are our degrees of freedom that we have to actually adjust the position. And if I can't adjust the direct position, can I adjust it indirectly? And then when I've done that piece, then you start working on let's make sure that we can't have this situation occur again. And as I mentioned, I did a lot of that by shrinking the portfolio as much as we could, and I did the second half of that by changing the managerial structure and the governance structures that we have in order to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
How important is valuation to risk management?
I think it's it has sort of a, I think it's very important, but I think it has a little bit of a taint to it because it's very important, but there's no doubt that if there's not enough transparency to help you with the valuation, and then you start to have to guess at the valuation, it adds to the complexity. So if you gave me only two states of the world, one state of the world was that I'm unsure of the valuation, so I will do nothing, and the other is I'm unsure of the valuation, so I will try. I would be in the I will try category, all right? So, but those are two extremes, right? The real question is, so how good is the try? How can you, can you try better? And do we think that that's appropriate? I do think that that valuation gives you a lot of leading indicators about where problems are. And the question is whether, again, do you have degrees of freedom to address those problems? And so one of the things that we look at is we look at the volatility of P&Ls, of the daily revenue stream. And we think about whether if the daily revenue stream is moving inconsistent with its history, is that giving us some indication of something that's happening? And the example I give is, going back a long time and early in my career, if you have someone who's working for you on a desk who's, let's say it's a young kid, and on a typical day, they make or lose $100, literally $100. That doesn't really rise to the attention of anybody of senior management. But if one day, instead of making or losing $100, they made $700, again, not a big number, but proportionally something changed. And as a risk manager, I'm always trying to understand what changed? Why did that $700 come in that day? And it may be a tiny thing in the spectrum of what we're doing, but that same lesson helps, I think, as a risk manager, you've got a responsibility for helping that junior trader, the person who's just starting, learn what it means to manage risk. And you have to be able to convey to them what's important. So anyway, I try to, I think valuations helps you understand that, in my example, the $100 and the $700. If you don't have a valuation, you can't begin to give that feedback and the managerial response.
Were there any tools that were missing or insufficient when you arrived with respect to valuing the CDO positions that Citi had?
Well, there were valuation models that the firm had, and the difficulty is that the marketplace, most valuation models where you have complex products, they're built to try to capture a range of outcomes, and there's sort of certain outcomes that are mathematically considered not feasible. And so to give an example, when I was in, I lived for about 8 years over in Europe, and there were times where the question of should an interest rate swap be able to trade at a lower yield than a government of the same country? And most people think that that should never happen. If an interest rate swap looks like a bank swap, then it should always trade at a higher yield than governments. But I believe Japan actually went negative for a little while. Now, you know, once it goes negative, you know, then the question is, well, have we done something? You know, that's new information. Could it go negative forever? You know, and in fact, in Japan, it was pretty soon they just said, no, that was some sort of degree of illiquidity. But I always remember at the time the Dutch bonds trading relative to German bonds, and I thought the two economies were carbon copies. And when I asked why you get paid so much more for Dutch bonds than for German bonds, you got a much higher yield. They said, you know, come on, it's like a little tiny state. Germany is the mothership. The Dutch are nothing. And then about a year later, they were trading flat. And I asked the same person the question. They said, come on, the Dutch is the really good state. The German government is nothing, you know. So there's sort of these rules that kind of get built in, and then, you know, the market changes, and the next thing you know, you're kind of reevaluating. So unfortunately, you know, I look at the housing market in the United States, I think people probably could have estimated, could have thought that housing prices would go down. I don't think people could have thought that housing prices would go down, you know, at the peak at the peak of negative sentiment. I mean, the marketplace was pricing 20 or 30% peak to trough and worried about 50% peak to trough. I don't know if today we're still worried about those same extremes, but there was a point there where people were really worried. When you construct a model to value something, you know, at some point you say, okay, that range of outcomes doesn't work, and you start to adjust models to say that range of outcomes is not possible. And so I think all of the mortgage models which kind of underlie these things began to really struggle with what underlying model assumptions were built into it. And so I think if people had projected what would have happened, then I think, one, you wouldn't have had the position on the books, but two, you would have had a better sense of what the ultimate risk appetite, what the ultimate risk outcome would have been.
What though, since your arrival, what have you done with respect to modeling of the CDO positions that Citi held? Did you and your group develop any type of new models? Did you improve on the existing models? What specifically, though, did your group do with respect to the CDO positions that you inherited?
So, the reality is, again, you probably hear it in the way that I approach everything. I own the position. I couldn't get out of it. Right? We had what we had. So, frankly, the most important thing was for us to get smaller in it. So we tried to find ways to get smaller. We have, over time, actually sold the position in a variety of ways. We've ended up, you restructure it, you basically sell it. We did a fair amount of work on the model to try to see if we could get the model to be more reflective of the market. I don't know that we really were successful in that. I mean, the market, you know, really didn't know how to price those things. We spent the time on it, but I'm not sure I could point to it and say that, and that was a raging success. I think the most successful thing we've done is to get the position down to a size that this institution could withstand. And obviously, in those first couple quarters or, you know, first three quarters, the size of the position was overwhelming the P&L of the firm. So,
Mr. Leach, I can't imagine starting a position and coming in to own somewhere around a $60 billion position without developing some views about my predecessor. who had left that position to me. And I would be interested to know, sir, your view of risk management under your predecessor, David Bushnell.
Arriving with the position that I had, you can imagine life was challenging. So I again don't know how don't know what he was focused on to bring that position at. But again, the world did change. So I'm trying to be, you know, I'm trying to be thoughtful and accurate about it. The world did change. So what I inherited in the world that I inherited in, that was a position that, you know, I don't think anybody would have wished upon. You know, certainly the bank, it caused, you know, significant issues for us. But for a lot of years, the world was viewed as real estate was an asset price that didn't go down. And if assets didn't go down, and real estate asset prices didn't go down, then super seniors were considered a fairly safe investment. So I can't put myself in his shoes. I don't know what his thoughts were. I know that the position I inherited was something I had to address. But that's been my approach to it.
Did you have the view in 2007? An asset that real estate prices want to go down?
I think I thought the world changed in roughly July, September-ish for real estate and for structured credit more than real estate. You started to see the world started to wobble. You have wobbles. The world wobbles all the time, right? But it wobbles and comes back. And so you had a few things in the 06 and the 05 and the 07, first part of 07, that were concerning. And I think if you different individuals would respond differently to that. But I really thought that kind of somewhere. It's a while ago now, but July, September, I thought that it really started to go differently. You saw a lot of the rating agencies starting to reevaluate whether the structured credit pieces were really what they appeared to be.
But prior to that time period, did you subscribe to the view that real estate prices would never go down?
I think we've seen examples where real estate prices have gone down. But we haven't seen them go down like this. Not on a national basis, Brad. And I wasn't running a portfolio like Citi. I mean, my historical experience didn't put me in a situation where I had to run a national mortgage portfolio along Citi's. But if you look at the Houston real estate crisis. That was a pretty bad experience, but it was Houston only. Japan had a real estate crisis go down in the lost decade, and that was a crash. But again, it was a country that people perceived as had excessive liquidity built up. I mean, in the outside world, I think when the Nikkei hit 40,000 or something, I think a lot of people thought. And that was not the sense of what was going on in the U.S. I mean, there was a sense that it was okay. So I tend to be of the personality that says, listen, anything can go down. Okay, there's, you know, tell me what it is. It can always go down. But I think if you were ask it in a fair fashion, which is, you know, so what do you think the downside case would be? Mm-hmm. I tell you, I don't. You can't come up with those numbers. And just to give you an example of how I think that the world really didn't have it, the person who's broadly attributed to having had the best insight into having it go down is one hedge fund manager, right? And he ran a hedge fund where he bet on it going down.
John Paulson.
John Paulson. Yes. I believe he raised funds under the expectation that the expected return would be in the mid-20s. Mm-hmm. Now, he had a fat tail that I believe, I've heard rumors, I haven't actually seen his documents, that maybe it could be as much as 500%. Mm-hmm. It was more like 700%, his fund had. So here's the guy who supposedly, absolutely, you know, saw it, and yet if he was raising funds with a sort of, you could make 20% off it, I know that he's publicly stated about how insightful he was, and as the market moves on and you've got things are moving in your favor, and I think he did a lot of work, I really do. But you know, he did raise funds with what I've been told, and you can verify that. But I've been told that he raised funds with sort of a mid-20s type of thing with a potential upside to it. But even he missed the scale of it. I think it would have been an interesting offering document where he would have said, I'd like to raise funds and my targeted ROE is 250%. I'm not sure he would have been very successful, so he may argue, you know, hey, Brian, I put 25 in, but I believed higher. But if you believed higher, you would have thought your distribution skew would have shown that. So I just think I'm trying to be fair to history. This is a pretty odd time period, and I think that a lot of people missed the scale of what could happen.
Mr. Leach, it seems to be human nature, though, that you were inheriting the seat to look back and say, I might have done things differently. And my question to you is, with respect to risk management on the CDO desk, would you have done things differently? And what would you have done differently?
I did the things differently that I've done now, which is I made sure I had experts in the seat who have a real estate background, that have a structured credit background. I've got a fundamental credit person because I think that's an area where, you know, I look at the overall risks that Citi takes, and Citi has, you know, a significant amount of risk in the real estate space, and has a significant amount of risk in the fundamental credit space. Those are the two large things, and then it has a significant amount of risk in the market space, right, in traded securities. There are different structures in place for each of those. I felt that we needed to do more there and put that in. Also have adjusted limits across the firm, as I said, in response to our new smaller size as an institution. Some of that is in response to the fact that the marketplace are more volatile and we needed to be smaller.
Have the way limits are set, has that changed?
I spend a lot of time on scenario analysis and fat tails and what could happen. And so that's a process of, that's a bit of how I think. As we start at the beginning, where I always think that there's an expected outcome, a slightly unexpected, a more unexpected, a more unexpected. To me, understanding the expected and the unexpected outcomes is very helpful for helping to get positions sized appropriately. And again, I'm looking from my perspective going forward. I look at how a position can cause problems. I want to make sure I'm sized right for that. And my, you know, my approach to this is, if you can think of if there's a scenario that you think is somewhat probabilistic, and I want to try to avoid the one that's, you can always come up with something ridiculous. If I live to 1,000 years old, okay, we got it. You're not living to 1,000 years old. That's a silly scenario. But if you've got a scenario that you can think of, and that scenario would cause a life-threatening problem to an institution, then you got to shut that off. You got to cut it off. And so what we've been doing a lot on our risk limits is to make sure that we don't have a situation where, whether it's CDOs or whether it's another flavor, that you put the institution at risk for that. And that's, but again, Brad, that's a that is what I refer to as risk appetite, and different institutions will have different risk appetites. I mean, the reality is there are hedge funds who raise capital with the absolute intent of having a significant volatility in their P&L, and people give them money because they want them, right? Their view is, I want that higher risk, potentially higher reward, and they manage money with that in mind. There are other institutions that manage their business to have their quarterly earnings be a penny higher than the previous quarter, right? Those are two extremes. I felt that the risk appetite for Citi, that we really need to defend the book value of the firm, and I shouldn't say I, because the reality is that's something that the board, the management group, we've all talked about that. That the concept is, in a relatively expected environment, let's make sure that what this year's EBIT will do is not jeopardized by the risk that is embedded in the portfolio. And so we've tried to resize for those.
Briefly, what is a fundamental credit person? You mentioned that, and you mentioned the real estate person. Yeah. If you could just define those briefly, I appreciate that they're probably complex.
If I do this well, then I'll put it on our website, because the person who is the fundamental credit CRO is asked the same question a lot. So, I wanted to differentiate between when you look at structured credit. Structured credit has some aspect of what companies, whether the companies are free cash flow positive, do they have a strong balance sheet. It has some of that, but it has an awful lot of how is the structure of the security built to protect the senior structure or the junior structure. So I wanted to have a structured credit person. I wanted to have another person who's a credit person, if I could just drop the word fundamental, just credit person. A credit person is supposed to be able to say, is the airline industry okay? Is company XYZ okay? Is the particular European government okay? So look at the fundamentals of those industries, look at cash flows, look at balance sheets, look at what those are. And in order to, and so I, instead of just using the word credit, I put the word fundamental credit to try to differentiate it from structured credit. So I have a person who is a CRO, one person really thinks through, is the airline industry doing okay, as an example, and the other person thinks about, is a structured credit item appropriate?
I see. You'd use the example of a junior trader and managing risk of a junior trader. How much does the way employees are compensated, such as traders, affect the way they approach risk? And have you made any changes with respect to compensation structures to address risk concerns?
There's no doubt that in a trading organization, any organization which is an incentive-based organization, compensation is designed to, in fact, encourage a particular behavior pattern. I mean, by definition, that's what an incentive compensation structure does. And in a trading environment, you want people to take the appropriate amount of risk. That's the artwork, and I'm really stressing the word appropriate, because you clearly want the organization to find the optimal risk reward that is appropriate. And I go back to the example where I said you might have a hedge fund who wants to make 40% ROE, and it has a fairly high probability that it may either make it or close, as opposed to someone who every quarter is making a penny more, right? Each of those have different goals, and you want your traders to, in fact, understand those goals and be reflective of those goals. And so when I look at a junior trader, what I always feel with a junior trader is it's the responsibility of his seniors, of that person's managers, to actually control that person's risk in such a way that the junior trader does not blow up And I, again, going through a lot of years of history, I always felt that the manager did a real disservice to a junior person and said, well, let's let them figure it out. Okay, we'll let them figure it out. Well, you shatter the person's confidence if early on they have a loss, which frankly is probably small by the firm standards, but large by their personal standards. You know, these are, you know, most kids who are coming in, you know, they're not used to losing, you know, $100, let alone $1,000, right? So I'd say that, you know, the cycle changes a little bit. You know, what you try to do is when someone is junior, you're trying to make sure that the senior person really has the control structures on them. And then as people learn, they move into that senior role, and it's their responsibility to help, you know, guide and govern the risk structure of the firm. The independent risk organization also helps on that. So I do think that pay structure is a key part of that. And I think that the industry, unfortunately, over time, moved to more and more to a current pay structure, cash for this year's work, and did not defer as much. And I can just go based on my own personal history. When I first started at Morgan Stanley, it was a private company. When you're a private company, you don't get paid until you retire. You know, I mean, you get a good, you know, year to year compensation. But in terms of the retained earnings that's multiplying inside the company, the exit is when you retire. Morgan Stanley went public in the mid '80s, and I started there in '81. So just to give some perspective on it. And they tried to maintain that partnership structure. And the idea was that you then got paid, but you got paid in very long-dated vested stock. And then a few years later, you know, frankly, the rest of the street was paying in shorter-dated stock and shorter-dated stock and shorter-dated stock. And the next thing you know, you get down to a very brief window. And I don't know where they were at the time when I finally left. I can't remember, but I want to say it's closer to 2 years at that time, but I might be wrong on that. And so I do think there is that you want to have your compensation structure have some duration to it. Now, of course, the other extreme is infinity, right? You know, you work until you die, and then your estate collects the infinity. And under that situation, I mean, I guess if the entire world was structured that way, maybe there's a business model that works. But my guess is most people would elect to choose a different business and not be paid zero until they die. So getting the mixture is important. I think it's only part of the picture. I really think that your risk governance structures and the risk control structures are a really big part of it. I talk about risk influences people's compensation literally every day. And they do that because when a deal is being discussed, and I or a member of my team look at it and say, you know, I don't want to be as big as X because I'm concerned about a few things. I want to be half X. The minute I'm at half X, then the upfront profitability has been halved. Now, I believe that the long-run profitability was obviously increased because the reason I went from X to half X was because I thought that fit the profile of the firm better, right? So I believe that that is an item. So when I look at it, there are lots of influence points that both business unit has. That business unit, there are frequently times where the business unit guy says, listen, that's interesting. We're not going to be that big. You know, I'm going to be half X. There are other times where I come in and say, listen, you're half X. I only want to be a quarter X. Mm-hmm. But the other aspect is you do want to, in fact, have a compensation structure which has some, I think, longevity to it. And we've done that, our comp structure. There are a number of things we've done where we've, you know, tried to put in place mechanisms to have stock and have stock come in over time.
And are these changes that have occurred since you joined the company?
I believe so. They're put in. We made, I think, some changes in 08 and some changes in 09. Some of those, and there are a variety of changes of which we've put forth a lot of those views. And I have done some other things with HR where, you know, we do RISC does a more formal review of our you know, significant of a subset of our people. Last year we reviewed a group of our senior leadership group in order to and assessed my group assessed those people as to whether we thought they were representing the culture of RISC that we were trying to do. So again, a fair amount of different things. Some can be mathematical, some are cultural. And I think that as a RISC manager, I know this may sound odd, but as a RISC manager, the mathematical ones are actually more problematic for me. Because I want the culture to be right. Because you can't literally block and tackle against every single door that you might leave open. And so the more something is mathematical, I actually find that less comfortable. I like the fact that at the end of the year we determine a compensation for someone, and they are and there is some doubt as to what the number was, because it leaves you a degree of freedom to say, you know, I didn't think you approached the following the right way.
How much say do you have, though, in someone's compensation outside of your RISC management team? And in other words, do you have a say in the compensation of, say, the CEO of the investment bank?
Mm-hmm. We've actually changed some of that for this year and for the years going forward. So my team will have more of a say. I have always felt that I had my say throughout the year. You know,
what changes have been made though going forward? Then
there is in fact a year end scorecard review process where in fact we go through several assessments about whether we believe someone has done the right approach to RISC, whether they understand RISC, whether they've taken hedging actions to deal with RISC, whether they in fact have a holistic view of RISC, and we assess people against those, and then based upon that, it has a compensation impact.
What persons are subject to that assessment where you would have an input in their compensation? I mean, for instance, is the CEO of the investment bank, is the head of the structured products desk, et cetera, et cetera.
So before the Fed has taken more of an interest on the subject this year, but before they took that interest, I did that last year in 08, not so 2 years ago, I guess now, at the end of 08. And we did that for the Senior Executive Committee of Vikram Pandit's, and we did that also for there's a group we call the Senior Leadership Council, and it's about 50 people in total. And there's a pretty much of an overlap. Everybody's an ex-co is a Senior Leadership Council.
Ex-co?
Executive Committee. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Executive Committee.
So, and that is the Executive Committee of?
Of Vikram's. So Vikram has a group of managers. I'm on the ex-co group. And then there's another group called the Senior Leadership Council. And I viewed that as an enhancement to someone's review at the end of 08. And I didn't need to link it to compensation. I felt, frankly, that I got better action and better clarity of view when it was independent from comp. And I'm sure you can imagine why. I mean, if I said to you, hey, listen, I need your opinion about Karen, by the way, whatever your answer is going to be plus or minus 10% in her comp, you immediately have you're trying to think of the words to achieve whatever you want it to. I don't know what you want it to. You wanted the comp to go up or go down. You pick. Whereas if I said, listen, it's really important to me that we get the right feedback. Can you give me some sense of what you think? So I felt in 08... we had a really effective process where I went through and reviewed people and the items that I thought we could work on. I had I was able to have a conversation with the managers and get behavior pattern changes that I thought were appropriate. In 09, we did it, but with a tighter link to comp, and I'm not sure which one's more effective. I guess.
Did you review the CEO of the investment bank?
Yeah. in both years.
Okay. And prior to your arrival, did Mr. Bushnell have a role in evaluating the CEO of the investment bank?
I don't know that. Okay. I could speculate, but I don't know that.
I appreciate that you were more forward-looking and your changes in risk. But there's an old saying, to define a problem is to begin to solve it, right? How would you define the problem with risk management at Citi when you arrived? If Mr. Panda or if the chairman of the board or the board of directors asked you when you arrived at Citi or shortly thereafter, Mr. Leach, what's the problems with risk management? What would you say? What would you have said?
I wanted more product expertise, which I went about picking up, both real estate and structured credit. I think the fundamental credit was built into the governance structure that Citi has, but I wanted it brought out.
So. And let me interrupt. These are people that were new, that knew how.
Correct.
So in other words, it's not just that you wanted them, but that they didn't exist at the time.
That's correct.
Okay. I just want to be clear sort of what was there and what wasn't right there.
And also, Brad, to be clear about that, I brought them in as someone who reported directly to me. The previous CRO had a business unit manager, and that business unit CRO. And that business unit CRO may well have felt they had that expertise inside their organization. I don't know that. All right. So I don't know. So going through from Bushnell to B.B. Duke, she may have had someone who she relied on to give her that insight. I wanted that insight to be at my level. Mm-hmm. All right. And I'm agnostic as to whether that was there or not. I don't know enough of her daily routine as to how people.
Right. And Brad, just to be clear, Brad is going to be meeting with Dave Bushnell and B.B. Duke, so there's a danger in speculating as to what happened that you did not focus on before you were there. So, and I don't want you to speculate.
Thank you. So I hired those two people to report directly to me. Right? And I wanted more information on our risk capital, which was why I brought Charles Monet in. So I wanted to have more insight into the potential risks that were in the portfolio. And again, all of those are things that I would say were, you know, front and center for it.
And then in layman's terms, risk capital means?
Oh, sorry. Risk capital is if you think you can lose a dollar, you better have a dollar available to lose. So you got to first do an estimate of that you might lose a dollar. That's an art unto itself, right? You own a house, and if I said the house was worth 100, and do you think in a fire sale, do you think it would sell at 90 or 80 or 70? You know, you would say that you have at risk $10, $20, or $30 in that example. So the first part is you have to estimate how much you think you might lose, and then the second part of it is, do you in fact have enough capital available to withstand that loss should it occur? And so in my house example, you know, if you can't, you know, if you're going to have to sell your house and lose $10, and because of that you can no longer, you know, buy food for the place, then you really can't afford the house, because, and so in a financial institution terms, it's a question of how much equity capital and other available resources you have to be able to withstand a potential loss.
So Mr. Monet's hiring in this position of Chief Risk Officer of Risk Capital at the top, does that mean you view there to be a deficiency in that area that prompted you to hire Mr. Monet and develop this position?
I felt that I needed to do it better, and so I wanted to improve that. We were experiencing outcomes that were unprecedented in the financial history that we've seen. I mean, we could we could guess what the Great Depression was doing, but we didn't have the same market structures that we had currently. And Charles has spent about 30 years thinking about risk capital. And frankly, I knew him from a couple from prior experience. He worked with me at Morgan Stanley, and he also worked in the at different points at J.P. Morgan and some of the government areas. And I just thought that he had a really good way of thinking through how to think about capital.
Were there areas when you came in that you thought were, in terms of risk management, were not independent and needed to be independent?
I don't think that, but it's something that is, I think it's like, you know, with your kids, you want to tell them to tell the truth. And it doesn't hurt to reemphasize it and reemphasize it and reemphasize it. So I wanted to reemphasize it. I did that a lot. But as I said earlier, I think that it comes with another item, which is that you need the independence, but you also need to be not afraid to have peer review. And peer review can come from inside your own business unit as well as the complaints from from the business unit colleagues. I think both of those are very, very valuable.
And you make changes to the way peer review was done?
I just made sure that at all of the meetings we had, that we had people who were, you know, frankly willing to speak their piece, and they understood that I had that I was going to make sure they had a safety net, that I'd catch them, but that they also should, you know, speak up, let people know what the concerns are, and also be willing to have people say we don't think you're right, and then defend it, justify it. And I think that that's just a, you know, it's the type of thing that culturally you want to make sure is really front and center, and again, it's just something that I feel is really important.
Mr. Leach, we've seen some various compensation numbers of persons in the investment bank and risk personnel and the like. Some of the differences are 30-1 in terms of compensation. Did you view a difference in compensation in terms of the amounts between, say, the CEO of the investment bank versus the chief risk officer? Did you view that compensation as having any impact in terms of the prominence of risk management? Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, CEO makes 30 plus million of the investment bank. Chief risk officer might make a million. Mm-hmm. Big difference there. Did that difference have an effect on risk management? And can you describe what differences that might have had?
You know, I think there's a lot of concern that differential pay gets you different status of organizations. And I'm not really a believer on that. I think there are different people get attracted to different jobs. Not every job has the same. It has the same compensation structure. You know, the brain surgeon makes a different amount than, I don't know, the hand surgeon. I'm not quite sure who gets more, but, you know, presumably there's different skill sets. And I look at it, and my thought is, you know, if a trader has, there's an immense amount of constant pressure on a trader. They really don't get a time off. It's the market is open these days 24/7. It takes an immense amount for that. That's a different job than a risk manager's job. A risk manager's job has I think certain personalities wear risk differently. There are some risk managers that are going to wear it 24/7, and there are some risk managers who wear it while they're in the office. I think I wear it 24/7, but they're just different roles, and I've had different roles throughout my career. So I appreciate why one person might want to be in one job at one point in their career and another at another. So I do look at. You know, there are, you're being motivated by different things. If I think about a professional football team, you know, the blind side, which a lot of people, you know, have seen, that position prices higher than virtually anything else on the field. And so if you're the wide receiver, Does that mean you now want to be the is it the left guard?
The left guard.
You want to be the left tackle? I'm sorry, the build of a wide receiver has no hope of doing that. And so, you know, if you can sing and dance like Madonna, then sing and dance like Madonna, if that's what you want to do. So I don't think that that is a root cause. I think that that is an interesting anecdotal item, but I don't think it's a root cause. If I want the best people, I've got to pay them. So, you know, I want good people working for me, and that means I've got to pay them. Now, does that mean I have to? Am I competing with the left tackle, or am I competing with the people that do risk management? And I'm competing with other people that do risk management. I have to pay them a fair wage for that.
City is obviously a very large organization. We've talked about how there have been attempts to downsize the business. Mr. Pandit certainly has spoken about that as well. There's City Financial, dealt with mortgage origination, subprime origination. There was the securitization group, dealt with securitization and RMBS. There was a separate group, dealt with CDOs. Have you observed anywhere where there was siloing of information? And what have you done to address the information flow from one business chain to another?
Mm-hmm. I think there are businesses that act as more an independent business in your phraseology, silo type structure. But what I have been impressed with at City is that they actually have a depth of information within those business units. The challenge in any large organization which has greater autonomy within a business unit is to be able to bring together the risk profiles or the capital structure profiles at the top of the house, and to me that was something that I felt was something I really wanted to make sure we did. Now, again, I have a slightly different hand that I've been dealt at that point. Right, it's less important to do that when you have a lot of excess capital. I did not have excess capital when I walked in the door, right? I mean, given the portfolio I had and given the nature of the risk. And so when you are in a scarce resource item, it's really important to, in fact, allocate that marginal resource very effectively across those silos. When you have excess, you can, in fact, keep a pool of excess at the mothership and parcel it out. So I felt that one of the things I wanted to do was make sure I had a very good information network for that. And again, you know, Brett, that's again why I go back to the things I did, right? I put in these structures to try to be able to pull them together. I wanted an overall real estate view, so I got the real estate person. I wanted to have a regional view, I got the regional view. I put in place some of the technology to be able to give me looks across the whole portfolio so I could run various scenarios to cut across all the firm. So I did a variety of things to make sure that I could do that in a fashion that was sufficient for my timeliness and the information I needed. And again, with not speculating about the prior regime, they may have been able to do that. I wanted to make sure I could do it in a way that fit my goals.
Yeah. When you arrived, were there certain reports that you were receiving, I mean, so-called dashboard reports or something that's been referred to in some organizations as dashboard-type reports, dashboard information? What were you receiving when you first arrived, and what did you ask for in terms of information? What reports, how is reporting to you, and by reporting I mean not, you know, so-and-so reports to so-and-so,
right,
but what actual reports, information
yeah.
flow, what new information are you now getting that you didn't get when you first arrived?
Well, I do remember, I mean, again, we're talking a couple years ago now, and it does feel like a different lifetime, but there was there was a massive amount of information, but the problems that I had were very idiosyncratic in nature. So very specific, right? Very unique.
What were they?
And one was the CDO position. Mm-hmm. One was the leveraged finance position. Mm-hmm. One was the CIF position. Mm-hmm. You know, so you look at the troubled positions we had. Those were the focus. So you could have provided me with any information, and no matter what it was, I would have needed more on those three. You know, and any of the others that we had as problem positions at the time. I'm trying to remember what the others were at the time, but it's like literally, when you know what the problem positions are, you need to just absorb as much data as you can. So I asked for a lot of information to try to figure out what can we do, how do we go about it, what are our choices, what are degrees of freedom, what are the things we can do. Additionally to that, I wanted to start giving the board a standard packet of things, because I thought that was important for the board to. I needed to communicate with the board effectively and consistently. And my perspective of good risk management practices is that you really want the board to receive some things that are very standard. So that every time they come in, they see this and this and this and this, and so they can see trend lines. But if you only focus on standard, you miss the nuances of what's changing in the business. So you also have to have this ability to do bespoke things. And so in the first couple board meetings, and again, I apologize because the history is going to blur on me here, but I believe in the first board meeting I was at, we had a stress test report that went across the entire organization and showed what the firm had at risk if the marketplace were to react consistent with historical scenarios as well as consistent with prospective scenarios. Mm-hmm. And that became a standard reporting packet that I didn't have before. And again, I think it was new, but I'm just saying, please check with the other colleagues, or ex-colleagues, I guess you'd say. And the other thing was I wanted that. So that was going to be my standard packet, was to be able to have them see stresses and have them see them by business units and have them seen later by corp versus holdings, have them see them by factors. Factors are... I understand that the entire firm might make or lose money under this scenario, but how about how much would you lose in interest rates? How much would you lose in FX? How much would you lose in equity? So you could get a sense of what those factors look like. That is my standard packet. And then what we did was we then said, and what about those positions that bother us the most in this moment? And those will change. So the reality was early on, CDOs were on that. You know, now I worry about whether various governments have the right capital structure, and without bias to any government out there, the government balance sheets are very different today than they were 2 years ago. So it gives you an idea of the portfolio has substantially changed over the course of the last 2 years. And so that would be the MIS that I would say was very different.
Okay. One thing that we've been challenging to us is to find out what happened to those positions that you inherited. The CDO position, to a lesser extent, the leveraged finance position. Our focus has not really been on the leveraged mm-hmm. finance position, but rather the CDO position and the SIBs. And I was wondering, I know that's a complicated question, so I'm hoping that maybe we can take that up offline in the sense that maybe you can provide some data to us in terms of what happened with those positions. I know there have been markdowns on the CDOs. I think there have been some markups. I know some of the CDOs have been, some positions have been sold off. And I know some of that is reported in your public filings, but it's somewhat difficult to ascertain sort of what happened where. And I was wondering if there was some information that it might be readily available to you and your group that we might be able to understand really what happened to CDOs leveraged finance and CIS, lesser extent on the leveraged finance, but mainly the CDOs and the CIS. Is that something that's...
We're happy to take you through all that.
That'd be great. I'm more interested in the high levels.
Right, from a high level, you actually have the answer. I mean, the reality is some of the position was, some of it matured, mm-hmm. Some of it was sold, mm-hmm. Some of it was written down, and some of it has recently started to be written up because the marketplace thinks it overdid the degree of it. But those are, you know, it's a little bit of each, to get the data behind that, you know, as we said, we'll get the data. But broadly speaking, what you're going to see is, you know, we sold some of it. Some of the people thought the buyers of it obviously thought it was a great purchase for them. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have been buyers if they had it. The reality is anything that people bought in the first half of 2008 was a horrendous decision by the time you got to the end of 2008. But probably where it is right now in the first quarter of 10, some of those may have been okay still. I haven't really followed. You know, usually when you sell something, you move on. You don't really consider the history after that. So.
Did you transfer any of the positions that you inherited over to the UK entity? There's been some allegation that there were transfers of CDO positions or holdings to the UK entity or UK arm of Citi and then sold off there. Do you recall of that being done at all?
Not that I know. I mean, I don't recall that. I think I want to differentiate between two things, right? If something was sold to an investor in some other jurisdiction, maybe there's a reason why you had to, in fact, sell it. Maybe it was, I don't know if it's, you. Maybe you have to move it to another jurisdiction to be able to be eligible to sell to that jurisdiction. I don't know that. But I don't know of something where a position was moved for some reason. I mean, and again, from risk standpoint, Brad, no matter where it exists in the world, it's still my problem, right? If it's here or in the UK or in the Antarctic, I still have to deal with it. So,
as far as I know, Citi has no business in the Antarctic, but
not that I know of either. So,
if you referenced that twice, so
your interview sure I was otherwise. No. I figured it was probably the clearest one that I was joking, but if
those markets froze first.
Oh, God. If in your interviews anybody else comes up with it, please call me.
I'm mindful of your time. That's why I keep looking down at the clock, and I do want to talk about sort of what happened in response to the government need. But I wanted to walk through a couple things that were put in the response. We raised some interrogatories in terms of practices that may have been changed at Citi and the like. And Citi's lawyers provided us with some responses, and some of the responses deal with risk management. And I can suspect, since your name is mentioned in the responses of what you did, you may have had a hand in those responses. Did you, or do you know if you had a hand in the responses?
I've been asked various pieces at times, so, you know.
That wasn't meant to be a trick question. I'm just curious to know what is meant behind some of the statements in here to sort of drill down. There's some
good.
and what I'm also trying to get at, Mr. Leach, is sort of what's new, what's improved, what's the same old sort of in terms of these practices. And so I have a couple just I want to run through briefly.
Yeah, I thought we've been doing that the last 2 hours, but go on. Please go on.
Well, we have been, but there's some specific statements here, and I just wanted to ask you about some of the statements here. One, it says to ensure the importance and independence of the risk function, Mr. Leach.
Where are you reading from?
I'm sorry, I should have. These are response to.
No, we have one. Which one?
Oh, I'm sorry. Page three. Page four. At page four under actions taken, I'm in the first paragraph on actions taken about halfway mm-hmm. through, Mr. Leach. It just says, to ensure the importance and independence of the risk function, Mr. Leach reports directly to the chief executive officer.
Some places don't do that.
Okay. Did your predecessor report directly to the chief executive officer?
I believe so.
Okay. Serves an executive officer of the Citigroup. Serves and is as an executive officer of Citigroup. Do you know if your predecessor served as the executive officer?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, why can't you ask us, or why can't you ask Dave Bushnell?
Okay.
Mr. Leach can go on with his job.
It's okay. We're good, Brad. I don't know. I actually don't know. I'm sorry.
Okay. We'll get to some of the more what you've developed new. Okay. And I appreciate your time, Mr. Leach, and I know
no
you
worries.
Have a
no worries. Let's
a big job to do. So there's a statement in the second paragraph that says the senior risk team has developed new industry-leading tools to monitor, aggregate, and evaluate risk exposures within and across cities, business, products, regions, including product risk, sector risk, geographic risk, and client risk. I know that's a broad statement, and that probably requires a long answer. And I certainly don't want to cut you off on a long answer, but I'm just interested in terms of, there's some reference to industry-leading tools. And earlier you had mentioned that some of the stuff that you do is proprietary, and you also mentioned that you didn't know what your competitors did. I'm just curious in terms of that phrase, industry-leading mm-hmm. tools. What do you know that you're doing different than your competitors to make sure that it's industry-leading tools? Mm-hmm.
I think the ability to run a stress test across at the group level, across the entire firm, my impression is challenging for competitors. And I'm saying that because in working with a variety of the regulators, particularly back in, now stress test obviously forced people to try to be able to do that, and I think some people must have had better systems for doing that or not. But we did our first one back, remember, before the stress test was put in by the government. So we ran our first stress test here. I told you that we took it to the board in the March or April board meeting. Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult thing to do, and to do it, I mean, it's easy to do it casually. It's difficult to do it robustly, and that tool allows us to kind of look at stresses now by region and by a variety of cuts, so we can take a look at things from various different cuts. And I think that's something that's was very good. I think probably the industry has moved with us post the stress test, because again they really got asked to do that on a more holistic basis. And again, I'd say the closer you are to a monoline investment bank, it's easier to do. It's harder to do when you're talking about the scope of geographic regions we have and the scope of businesses we have. And so I think that's a very helpful tool for us as a risk management group.
There's going down to the third paragraph on that, third full paragraph on the page. It starts with Citi also has developed more dynamic risk measurement processes and systems that permit the rapid modification of risk assumptions, particularly stress shock assumptions, to reflect the current circumstances. I'm sorry, goes on. Mm-hmm. The next sentence, though, is what I wanted to ask about, is the company has improved and embedded its capital model into risk control. Two questions with that. One is, what do you mean? I apologize, I just don't understand mm-hmm. what that means. And the second question is, Is that something new then, as compared to your predecessor?
I tend to think about, if you think about an opportunity to invest in an asset, and I'm going to give you two examples, right? One asset, on both assets you expect to make a dollar, right? Fully expect to make a dollar. And on one of them, if you're wrong, you lose a dollar, and the other one, you lose $2. So pretty simple two-asset class category, right? Mm-hmm. Both of them make a dollar, but if you're wrong on one, you lose a dollar, the other, you lose $2. The simple question, which one would you avoid? The $2 one, right? Mm-hmm. You could make a dollar and lose two. Why would you do that when you can make a dollar and only lose a dollar? Mm-hmm. Clearly, right? In a very narrow discussion, you would always choose the dollar for dollar. If I gave you one other piece of information that says most of the time you expect to dollar for dollar, but if you're wrong, I take your firstborn. You, depending on how well you like your kids, you know, you will decide that that first one, even though it seemed overwhelmingly positive, is in fact not as good as the second one. And it's a different, it was what I was describing earlier, it's a different point on the curve, right? Mm-hmm. So you've assessed, in the first example, you assessed the expected outcome relative to the likely downside, mm-hmm. $1 or $2. In the second piece of information I gave you, it was the expected outcome relative to the unexpected outcome, loss of your firstborn or some other mm-hmm. number. And that, I believe that is something that really enhances how you think about risk. And so when you think about businesses and where do you want to have capital invested, I want to be able to, I look at how do I think about how much capital is invested in businesses that have a continuum of risk outcomes that's consistent with the risk appetite of what I think of, you know, what the board, what the management team thinks Citi should have. So that's what that sentence is trying to say.
Okay. And this embedding of its capital model and risk control, is this something new?
It means that you think about it all the time. And
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt. Go ahead.
Yes, sorry. It just, the embedding means I want people thinking about that all the time. I want them to think about it when they're, you know, trading on the desk or when my risk group is coming into it. I felt that we needed to do more of that. Brad, I don't know what they did before. So, again, you got to ask Dave how he handled that thing. I look at it as saying that was something that I wanted to make sure that a risk group had a view and an opinion about what the continuum of outcomes could be relative to the rewards.
One other question or a couple other questions on this, and then we'll move on in the interest of time to the other topic. liquidity stress and sensitivity analyses are part of the company's business and investment decisions. Know whether or not liquidity stress and sensitivity analysis were part of the company's business and investment decisions prior to your arrival? I know the answer might be I don't know, but I think you can probably appreciate we're trying to see the changes in risk analysis.
But you're going to speak to the people from before, and then you can just compare them. He said 15 times he hasn't done a study of the past.
I appreciate that, Mr. Leach, but the difficulty that we have, obviously, is when we do talk to your predecessor, he's going to say, I don't know what was changed.
Right.
And then,
but you'll know.
And so what I'm trying to find out is what was new? What did you do new with respect to
this point? We raised over $100 billion worth of equity.
Okay.
So, we raised about $130 billion worth of equity, which I think roughly 45 is the U.S. government, and the rest is either raised in overt fashion by issuing stock preferreds or shrinking the balance sheet, which frees up capital, doesn't raise capital, but frees up capital. So, I look at that and say that's a lot of capital raised. Mm-hmm. We increased liquidity, as I mentioned earlier, in two large chunks, both when I first came in, and then post-Lehman, we did another large increase. So when you think about trying to increase, what's the sentence structure? I'm sorry, I've lost the page.
Liquidity stress.
Liquidity stress and sensitivity analysis. You can assume that if I thought there was liquidity stresses and sensitivities that were causing me angst. If they didn't cause me angst, I wouldn't have made the recommendation to raise the amount of liquidity and the amount of capital that we raised. We raised a ton of that. Now, again, I recognize the frustration, Brad, and I'm sorry, but I am the beneficiary of seeing what the market already did. So I look at what the market has done and say, boy, we better raise more capital. Mm-hmm. What I don't have is the perspective of the person in my seat before, what they were looking at to, in fact, determine whether they thought they were appropriately liquid and appropriately capitalized.
One more question on this subject.
Okay.
It's the famous last words for a lawyer when he says one more question on the subject, because there's usually never one more question on the subject. But I'm hoping that this is truly the last question on this subject. And that is the following is, you spent some time seconded to long-term capital management.
Yeah.
Excuse me, LTCC. Were there any lessons that you observed from your time there that you've applied in your new role here as Chief Risk Officer, and what are those lessons?
I thought the biggest lesson from LTCM, and I actually had a conversation with regulators about it way back when, at the time of coming out of LTCM, was the derivatives book was really tough to deal with. And for them, it was an interest rate swaps book. But it really was the benchmark item that got in the way of being able to smoothly affect a liquidation. And if I back up the clock a bit, because I think things change so dramatically that things that we take for granted now were not taken for granted back then. They had a swaps portfolio which was very large. I want to say it was certainly one of the top five largest swap portfolios in the world, and they were not a bank. They were just a counterparty. May have been even higher up than that. The marketplace at that time did not have a very good means to keep track of every swap. Everybody had systems, but the systems were not centralized. They were not well understood. The second thing was there was no tool to allow people to take a portfolio of swaps and simplify it into its core components. And so to unwind the so to give you an example of this, imagine I'm the troubled counterparty, and I have bought a asset from Karen, I sold a similar asset to you, almost the same, right? Bought over here, sold over here. So I bought, sold. The reality is those four things really cancel. And as a going concern, the world considers me to have no position. The moment I am a bankrupt counterparty, the world actually, each of you, no longer take comfort that I'm going to be able to send cash flows back and forth. The world actually now wants to treat me as a one-off counterparty. So everybody I owe money to, they want to pay earlier, and everybody who owes me money wants to pay me at the end of the day. They want to collect early and delay. The marketplace did not have a tool to allow to take that whole portfolio. And so what the marketplace at the time wanted to do was charge an exorbitant amount to close off each individual swap, one at a time. You literally would go to one of the major banks and say, I have 3,000 swaps on with you. And they'd say, okay, swap number one, we'll charge you $10,000 for it. Swap number two, which is the exact offset to swap number one, I'm going to charge you $10,000 to. And if you added up all the $10,000, it was infinity. And it was, and so the insight that I had at that time was that the going concern, a bankrupt counterparty and a going concern counterparty are completely different in a derivatives book. They're very different. And so I know this isn't the subject matter that you started from, but the when I look at the job that you guys are trying to do. There's a lot of focus on legislative. There's a lot of focus on regulatory. there is not very much focus on market structure. Mm-hmm. And market structure, I think, is the root cause of this issue. I think all everything else gets in line behind market structure. And what happened post-LTCM was the banks realized they were never going to get the swaps counters closed out unless they could start dealing with it as a unit. And so they built tools at the time to allow you to give them, you have 1,500 swaps, oh, these all net out, and all you really have is this one thing. So we'll charge you the amount necessary to close that, and the rest of these we're just going to cancel. That tool, once it was built, was what allowed the swaps market to function for the next 10 years, because it allowed, in a troubled counterparty situation, things to be closed very quickly. Those same two issues have a lot to do with the CDSs, not CDOs, CDSs, in the most recent 5 years. You had explosive growth in the CDS marketplace. The industry's knowledge of where each one of those contracts lies was less than perfect. There's been a huge focus by the Fed over the course of the last several years to actually fix that and get those onto clearing corporations, as I'm sure you've seen, mm-hmm. to in order to be able to know who owns the items. But the ability to net the swap the CDS portfolio down really has only come into fruition about 2 years ago. So these, just blanked the name, the netting of the swap portfolios, the netting of the CDS portfolios, and there's a term for it, has needed a tool to be built for it. That, from my perspective, one of the things that I think from a market structure standpoint is that if you have a greater transparency and greater standardization amongst the derivatives, you in fact lessen this issue dramatically. And I've been very clear about that, honestly, from, I guess it's more than 10 years now, but 10 years ago and 2 years ago, where, I really do believe that if you had transparency on the CDSs, you would have, in fact, had a margin process. You would have had net downs. You would have had it. You would have made it very difficult for counterparties to ensure market movements, which subsequently proved to be that they couldn't insure. And if you had realized how big their insurance was based upon the fact that it was on an exchange, I think it would have changed the outcome. Dramatically changed the outcome. I might even go so far as to say I'm not sure we would have even had the outcome, because it would have prevented the issue. So when I look at that part, that experience in my life, that is one of the key determinants and the key issues that I think is important.
That's fascinating. I appreciate that perspective, Mr. Leach. On that note, with respect to CDS, in your view, was it really the transparency element that was really driving the problems, or was it the lack of posting of collateral, or both? Because I've heard both, and as you can appreciate, we've been looking at the CDS market, and I know this is far afield from the initial purpose of our interview today, but you've obviously got an incredible perspective as a market participant and who's someone who's experienced long-term capital and seen the aftermath. I'm just curious in terms of the transparency versus the posting of collateral, where you see the two factors being at play.
I think it's both of those, but I think more importantly, and it has to do with, there's a concept here of transparency and posting collateral, which is this issue, which is it has to do with standardization. Because, again, the issue that in my previous example, the swap that I buy and sell from you, if that was a New York Stock Exchange security, I buy the stock and sell the stock, I have no position left. It disappears. It's gone. When you have a bespoke structure, I buy the one, sell it to someone else. Both of those live. Now, the first one I may have bought was a 5-year, and the second one I sold was a 5-year. but 24 hours passed, so my maturity date is now off by a day. So they kind of are offsets, but they're not quite offsets. And so, again, going back to this time period in history where you have a mortgage market which is being impacted by the fact that interest rates are very low. You actually have high cash balances in the United States, probably post 9/11. Essentially, post 9/11, treasurers got very worried about having enough cash, and they increased cash. They start to look for places to put that cash to use, and they want to keep it liquid in money market-like securities. But money market securities don't produce enough yield, so they try to look for something else. China is looking for places to invest. Those macro influences are gigantic. They're gigantic, right? So you've got a lot of cash that's flowing through the system, and it starts to essentially find its venue in the form of lending to people purchasing houses, and then lending to subprime borrowers and people purchasing houses. The people who are lending the money begin to look for protection against default risk. And they get that in the form of, they structure it in the form of CDOs, but they protect themselves in some cases on some of the more challenging tranches by getting CDSs from the marketplace. Those CDSs get provided by market participants who in fact are not held to a market standard, because they're not on an exchange, you don't see the margin, you don't see the quantity. And so if you think about all of the institutions that provided insurance against CDOs, and if you simply said, those people, if you're going to have provided that, I actually think it's a good thing that people provide insurance against various products, I just want them to be capitalized appropriately for it. So if you have that insurance provided in the CDS form, and it was in fact in a transparent fashion, in a standardized fashion, you would then have the marketplace would have looked at that and said, you need to post X amount of margin. Those institutions would have been posting massive amounts of margin, well beyond what they, I think their board or their management or their regulators would have said works. And as a consequence, they would have had to cut off that provision of insurance. And if you cut that provision of insurance off, then I believe that the marketplace would not have been able to create more CDOs. And if you can't create more CDOs, you would have actually lent less to the subprime market. And if you lent less to the subprime market, then the housing market can't, in fact, go up as much. So a very simple market structure item, in my mind, would have acted as a brake line against an awful lot of follow-on impacts, and I believe it's actually a substantial amount. I mean, I'm not sure that I can get myself to say all, but I'll tell you, I think it's massive.
On the challenges with respect to CDOs and risk management, this is something you said struck me, and City Financial is a lender, holds mortgages on their books. Securitization, one level removed. CDOs, one level removed. Is there a greater risk the farther you get away from the ultimate borrower, whereby it's more difficult to manage that risk?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, risk to me, I try to look through the prism of saying how much could something go down. And so if I look at it, whether I look at it as a table or a stock, as long as I kind of try to keep in perspective of what's the chance that that could be impacted. So in some cases, the transmission mechanism is easier to see. In some cases, it's more difficult to see. So someone loses their job, it is likely that they're going to pay less, and that means your credit card portfolio is going down. There's a transmission mechanism, but you've got to understand the various transmissions, and it's not as clean as I've just said. I mean, they lose their job, they have a big bank account, they're going to still pay their bills. So it just gets a little more difficult. In many cases, the purest financial contract of a stock is in many cases the purest form of being able to see that. But of course, it has a business model issue behind it. You go to the very purest, it's a government bond where you say in theory there's no government risk and the price goes up or down. That's kind of the easiest deal. Everything after that has some degree of complexity. All right,
and I apologize. I have you 5 o'clock court argument for you guys.
Good luck.
5 o'clock court argument. Wow.
Okay, so
let's shift gears then. Okay. Thanks, Brad. I appreciate your time. Thank you. Thanks very much, Brad. Do you need to take a...
I'd love to just get a cup of water.
Quick break. Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm going to make sure that we stop right at 5 o'clock to be respectful of your time. I have just a couple questions on the ring fence. Okay. Thank you very much.
Pause the recording. We're going to...
And Karen is underpaid. That's the... We are going back on record. It is 4:29 p.m. on March 4th, 2010, and we're continuing with the interview of Brian Leash, the Chief Risk Officer at Citigroup. Mr. Leash, shifting gears, wanted to talk to you about the events that led up to the need for government assistance. You've been designated as a person with knowledge on that. I want to make clear that we're not relitigating TARP or government assistance or anything like that. Our interest in this area is to understand the challenges, financial difficulties and challenges of Citigroup that ultimately resulted in the need for government assistance. It's not to question the need or anything of the sort, but I'm just interested in that. We've talked to your colleague, Mr. Kelly, yesterday quite extensively. I don't want to rehash what we've talked about. I thought the conversation was helpful and meaningful. But he had indicated that you had some knowledge about the negotiation of the ring fence agreement and what assets went into those ring fence agreements. And we're trying to understand basically the assets there and the reason or presumed need for putting those assets in a ring fence. And if I could get you to just describe how you went about identifying the assets that went into the ring fence, the negotiations that went on with respect to those assets, how you evaluated in terms of what assets went in the ring fence, what assets did not need to be in the ring fence. If you could help us understand that.
Okay. So the ring fence was, obviously was an interesting transaction. And if I think it's helpful to understand the genesis of the ring fence, which was when we were in discussions with the various government entities about the purchase of Wachovia, as the again reflective of all my colleagues, but as the CRO, I was very concerned about the quality of the Wachovia assets. There were assets there that I felt had potential downside that may have been okay, but may ultimately prove to be quite costly. And so when we were trying to think of a structure that may or may not make sense for Citi to be involved in a transaction like Wachovia, we essentially said, what we really want is some way to ensure the fat tail, the downside, the unexpected downside. Now, the precedent before that is actually J.P. Morgan and the Bear Stearns transaction, right? So in the J.P. Morgan Bear Stearns, they are asked to help. And the Fed, I'm not sure if it's the Fed, Brad, is it the Fed who immunized the first loss with, I don't know their transaction. I'll just say before you quote that, please check that fact.
Sure, yes, sir.
But the Fed took it ultimately got redone a little bit. I think JPM takes the first billion, but I think the night of the deal, it was announced that the Fed was going to take the first X billions of dollars worth of losses And then I think subsequently JPM took the first billion and the Fed took the next amount of loss. And I want to say, time fades. Was that 20 billion or 30 billion? I mean, it was a big
one. I think it was 30.
I think it was 30. Just one of those where I look back and I go,
29.
Yeah,
29.
I think it's 1 in 29. And so you think about what value transfer was given to JPM at that time, right? So they end up with an asset that had, you know, they picked up a lot of presumably good assets where the structure was them for a bill, the next 29, and then they were on the hook for beyond that, right? Our thought of Wachovia was that was the inverted structure. I was, as a risk manager, comfortable with having the first set of exposure. So in the JPM one, the example being that first billion, well, my view on that is we should be willing to take the first amount of loss based upon what we think we know about the portfolio. And we've done our work, but, you know, you always can do more, and you'll know more as time goes on. But there is a point beyond, which would be that where your thought is if there were to be an unexpected outcome, losses beyond something, that's something that we don't know where we were sitting on at the time of thinking of Wachovia. You don't know the outcomes beyond what you know. And so, in theory, the various regulators would have known what sat beyond the known in the Wachovia example. And so we talked about a structure where Citi would take the first loss, so that $1 billion became much larger. And again, I'm sorry because I'm not prepping for the details on this. So I forget what our number was, but we had, you know, Citi would take losses of X number of billions, but we wanted to be able to say if for some reason the housing portfolio that sits inside Wachovia is worse than that, then we wanted to be immunized beyond that number. Mm-hmm. And that was what the original Wachovia transaction was designed to do. That structure was something we frankly had a lot of discussions with the various regulators on, right? So what do you want us to do? What do you mean by that? You know, so there was a lot of knowledge that existed between Citi and the regulators about a ring fence structure, right? I don't actually know if we called it a ring fence in Wachovia or not, but as that reinsurance kind of structure. So when we got to that weekend where Citi's stock was really under pressure and the market was really rife with questions about solvency, we were trying to address, well, what is it that the market's worried about, right? And again, you got to really back up the clock here, as I'm sure obviously in the job you're doing you're seeing, because the things that the market worries about today are just very different back then. And there was this concern about the transparency of everybody's balance sheet. There were worries about the scale of off-balance sheet activity, and there was worries at the time about the scale of level three assets. And so our thought was, what we've got to do is we've got to be able to give the market some comfort that we believe that we can help you understand them, but if you're really going to create the extreme outcome that I may disagree with your extremeness, but it's hard for me to, in fact, it's hard for me to make you comfortable when I say that that's a ridiculous outcome. So my earlier example, if I live to 1,000 years, I don't agree with that. But if that's what you're going to drive my stock price off of, well, I've got to figure out some way to make you more comfortable with that. So our discussion with the regulators was about trying to create a structure that would at least remove that fear from the marketplace. That in essence, that the government would would act as the ultimate protector of those assets. Now, I think our perspective from the government's thing was, if you did that, you in essence gave the marketplace some comfort that it couldn't be worse than X, and ours was this was a pool, as you know, of about $300 billion worth of assets with a first loss. Our first loss was $38 billion on it, and so our thought was we could give the market comfort that it couldn't be worse than that. Now, of course, I think from the government's perspective, harshly speaking, if you hadn't survived the next 2 seconds, the government actually owned that position anyway, right? In fact, they owned the first loss as well as the subsequent loss. So in many ways, our thought was that from a government standpoint, it gave the marketplace comfort, and it also was a structure that we thought the government would see that it didn't disadvantage them relative to their current position.
A few questions on that. So the ring fence was not motivated, or was it motivated in any part by concerns over your capital ratios?
Lots of things. You're concerned about lots of things. Uh-huh. But if one of what the marketplace is focusing on, do you have the right kind of capital? Are there losses beyond what we know? You know, it's one of those, your stock price is low, so it must be down for a reason. What is it that someone knows that we don't know? You get into this very group dynamics, which may or may not be accurate, but you've got to try to address.
Sure.
And so with that background, that's how we tried to pick assets, right? You try to pick assets that would accomplish two goals. One was to pick the ones out that the marketplace may have the most concern about, mm-hmm. and second, that the didn't feel like you disadvantaged your insurer by the fact that you were picking them. And so what we tried to do was pick groups of assets. And not in every group of assets, there's always going to be one, a bunch of bad ones and one good one, or a bunch of good ones and one bad one. Our thought was just pick the whole asset class. That way, you could not, when you're working with an insurer, you don't insure 100 people's health other than that one person standing over there, for whatever reason.
And just to be clear, the insurer you're talking about is the government.
It's the government, okay. Correct. And so. The government, because they provided the insurance against the ring fence, we paid a premium. There is a deductible, and there is a notional amount. And so I think the ring fence is oftentimes written about poorly. The reality is we paid a premium. It was $7 billion.
Roughly $7 billion.
Okay, $7 billion of premium. There was a $38-ish billion deductible. And the insurable quantity was 300, right? And so, not unlike buying insurance, fire insurance on a house, right? There's a deductible, there's a premium, there's a deductible, and then the house is insured for, whatever, $100. That was the same construct. Mm-hmm. So what we were trying to do was we wanted to construct something that would allow the marketplace to say, okay, We understand now, that if there is a problem, because the market was worried, if there is a problem, at least we know it can't be bigger than $30 billion, right? And on the flip side, trying to be fair to our insurer, we wanted to make sure that we didn't just put in all the sick people, but, also the healthy people and the sick people, using my analogy of health insurance. The concept was a blended pool. Now, it wouldn't have helped if I just put all government bonds in, right? I mean, if I put government bonds in, the insurer's happy, but the marketplace is looking at it saying, well, that wasn't what I was worried about. I wasn't worried about your government bonds. So we tried to pick assets that we thought that the marketplace perceived as having a very uncertain payoff profile. It may or may not have been a good payoff profile, but there was a degree of uncertainty that we felt the marketplace would be helped by, helped understand the risk of Citi by putting a limit on effectively the deductible. Now, I, as a risk guy, the deductible was massive. It's massive, all right. And so, I think subsequently, by the way, the market deteriorated, and it looks less massive, but it was still massive. And so, you know, it'd be insuring a $100 house and having the deductible be, you know, I don't know, like a big number. Okay, so. But the marketplace really had got themselves convinced that the $100 house could somehow create, you know, $1 million worth of losses. So even with a large deductible, I mean, our view on it, we knew our portfolio. We thought we knew what the downside risks are. We thought we were going through that path. And I'm saying thought because you never perfectly know. You know, you just know what you've done the analysis on. So I thought that it was a, you know, the portfolio you're trying to do is be able to send a signal to the marketplace that says that it's the downside on this thing is $38 billion, which I think the marketplace was, the day before they heard that, were thinking that, well, it could be way more than that. I don't know what way is. I use the exaggeration to sort of indicate. So at 38, I'm going, wow, 38 is a huge amount, right? I hope to God we never lose $38 billion on this portfolio of $300 billion. And if we do, by the way, that would imply some really bad things are happening across the United States. That would not just be a city problem. That would be a massive issue. So really, again, trying to pick your question, to answer the specifics of your question, we tried to pick a portfolio that sent a signal to the outside world that we've put a floor on how far down these assets can go, the ones that you guys are most worried about. We tried to pick a portfolio that the government, the insurer, would say, okay, listen, that's fairly representative, and you haven't biased the portfolio to try to do something. And then internally, I would say, as the risk guy, I looked in going, I can't believe that I don't believe that we're going to ever end up needing that insurance. But if that's what it takes to have the market have confidence in us as an institution, then I understand that.
You've mentioned level three assets, and part of our mandate as well is to look at accounting and mark-to-market accounting. And Mr. Leach, I was wondering if you could describe the challenges that Citigroup faced leading up to the need for government assistance with respect to accounting and accounting treatment of assets, and if there were any lessons learned, so to speak, about accounting that you could share that would be helpful.
We talked a little bit about that earlier in the sense of just, I do believe that trying to determine a price is better than not determining any price. But there are some pro-cyclicality things in accounting that I think it'd be helpful to not be quite as far down the road on the pro-cyclicality items. And I think it's, the last several years, the forces that have been driving have been trying to make sure that there's absolute transparency on the balance sheet. And to do that, it means no off-balance sheet items, and let's put a price on everything. And again, generically, I think that's a good thing. It happens to be that all of that was coalescing at exactly the same moment that the housing problem kicks in. And so you take the series of financial institutions, and at the moment that you're beginning to have a housing problem, you actually balloon the balance sheets, right, at the exact moment when people are trying to assess capital structure. So one of the interesting data points for you is, if you look at the top, the 50 largest financial institutions around the globe, and you look at their balance sheet in June of 07, and then look at their balance sheets in December of 08. So here it's in the midst of the crisis, right? And all you heard about was people trying to get rid of assets, get rid of assets, get rid of assets. In June of 07, it was about $38 trillion for the top 50. And in, I think it's June of 08, actually, a year later, they're at $50 trillion. So the balance sheets are ballooning. The equity capital is getting destroyed because people are losing in mark-to-market. And what we have is yet again, I mean, again, you've got this incredibly broad mandate. What you have is yet again a convergence. I mean, I hate to use the perfect storm, but the perfect storm coming in where not only you have these giant macro items that are coming in, but the accounting practices was saying, put everything on balance sheet. And again, I agree with that. It just so happened it all came on at the, like, how about staggered in? Okay, and now, do we believe level three assets? Again, spotlight on level three assets. Well, level three assets is an issue that has been, you know, had been part of finance for several years. And if level three assets had been addressed, 5 years earlier, may not have been as big an issue. If off-balance sheet addressed, 7 years earlier, if you'd staggered some of these really macro-level items, I think you would have mitigated some of the issue. And so so the pro-cyclicality of some of the accounting policies, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of stuff about where, Spain supposedly has an accounting treatment that allows, less pro-cyclicality. What that really comes down to, though, is the management judgment where you say, I'm really nervous about the credit environment, so I'm going to build my reserves up a little bit. The flip side of that is people worry that you are, in fact, having too much management discretion. And so they want it more mathematically. And as I said to you earlier, the more you make things mathematically, you take out that judgment. And I tend to think that you want judgment, but you want good governance, right? If you've got good governance and you set some good standards, race to the top, not race to the bottom, race to the top, get some good standards set, and then I think that you could have had some accounting features that would be less pro-cyclical. Most significant of that is reserve builds and stuff that is similar to how Spain looks at it. And a little bit of that is the level three, a little bit of that is the off-balance sheet. Those are now fixed right there. They're gone.
Now, you mentioned off-balance sheet. Just prior to your arrival, there was a decision by Citi to take on balance sheet and support the SIVs. What has happened with those assets? I know there was roughly about a $3.3 billion write-down on the SIVs throughout 08. And I'm not asking you to attest to those numbers. I believe those are my calculations offhand. And then there was an announcement of a $17 billion or so in payment in late 08 to unwind the SIVs. What happened with those SIVs? Were they part of the ring fence? And what's ultimately been the end result of the SIVs? I mean, what's the conclusion of the SIVs?
The SIVs had a fair amount. It had assets that range from shorter dated to longer dated, mm-hmm. And so as time marches on, a lot of the assets actually just mature. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the assets can be sold, and again, so just it's really just position management with the SIVs. We took the assets on board and you try to sell what you can, and you try to, if it's illiquid, you mark it down. You try to find a bid. Some of it matures, so it's not unlike the discussion we had about the CDOs or the leverage finance positions. The reality is, lots of different things happen to them, but we've kind of continuously shrunk the position size, but it's all on balance sheet. It's all it's all part of the firm right now.
And they were not part of the ring fence, or they were part of the ring fence?
It's not a SIV per se that becomes the ring fence. It's the asset in the SIV.
Right.
And I think I think we put those assets, I believe they went into the ring fence. Can I ask for,
okay. Check that through documents.
Okay. And, because I think they essentially, a lot of those were financial, they were securities where the underlying was financials, and financials were considered vulnerable, and so I think we looked at that and thought they should be in there.
Now you've described investor perception. Couple more questions, and I'm going to get you out of here by five, sir. You've described investor perception and the like, and there was the announcement on around November 19, 2008, with respect to Citi's unwinding the sieves, and the announcement then of the government assistance was not long thereafter, November 23, 2008.
The November for unwinding the sieves. Do you mean the November 07 when we brought the sieves on balance sheet?
No, sir. There was an announcement, and I apologize. I'm not asking you to. There was an announcement, according to what we've seen, on or around November 19th. 2008.
Unwinding them. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
There was an announcement of a $1.1 billion write-down on the sieves, and then an announcement about unwinding a $17 billion payment to unwind. Mm-hmm. That was November 19th, 2008. The government assistance then was November 23rd, 2008. And do you have an opinion, sir, of whether that announcement on November 19th, 2008 added to this perception that you described earlier concerning transparency of the balance sheet and investor perception in that?
I don't think there's a linkage, but I think every announcement by Citi at the time would have gone into a investor's mindset as to what's going on. I think the investors, Bradbill, would have thought the assets of the sieves were already on the balance sheet. I hope they would have looked at the announcement roughly a year earlier, and realized they were on balance sheet. I think the announcement of the unwind was the mechanics of having it go from a guess of unwinding the SPE structure. I don't know that brought it onto the firm's balance sheet, and I don't think that should have changed it, but again, I wasn't sitting in the investor's mindset, so I would have hoped that they would have thought it was the previous year was the most important time. You've got one more question you want to hit me with?
Yes, sir. 4 minutes, and I want to be out of here and respectful of your time, and I appreciate it. It's very helpful to what we've done. Last question, and I should have asked this earlier, with respect to regulators, were there any changes in terms of risk management that you did as a result of an instruction recommendation by a regulator?
None that I can remember. I think there were things that I did that regulators, effectively encouraging. Where they go, we like what you've done in terms of, we like the people you've hired, we like the fact that you've got this. You don't say like. It's more neutral than that. But I certainly saw a lot of regulators and some of the regulators offshore do go so far as to say, we like what you've done. But there's no. The narrow response is the regulators never came into risk management and said you must do the following. I don't believe there's an example where I can think of that.
What did a regulator say they liked that you did? You mentioned the like, and I know you mentioned that most of them remained neutral. But what was it that received the favoritism?
People felt that there was a a real positive. A cultural change in the risk management group where there was a stronger sense of team. I think the comments that we got on the stress testing early on were very positive. And we built a tool to be able to look at individual credit across the whole firm, and that was perceived as very positive. So I think there were things that people would say, you know, you'd hire someone in, and they'd say, I really, I thought, you know, I like the hire that you've made on person X, Y, or Z. And so they, so you kind of got, you knew if you were headed in a direction that at least was consistent. But I wouldn't say there was ever a point where they'd say, you know, you're the, as my grandmother would have said, you're the bee's knees on, you know, something X, Y, or Z. They, it's done differently than that, I think.
I think, Mr. Leach, we've exhausted your time, and with 2 minutes to spare, and short and in closing, we appreciate your time, and we appreciate your cooperation, and certainly that of your colleagues at Citigroup and your counsel throughout this process. We certainly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, my grandmother.
We are ending at 4:59.